Nearly 200 Catholic leaders from around the world are at the Vatican this week for an unprecedented summit on preventing sex abuse by clergy. Pope Francis is calling for concrete and effective measures to address the crisis, among them a handbook for how churches should handle accusations of abuse when they emerge. A group of scholars in the U.S. says that part of the key to preventing abuse lies in restructuring the priesthood and addressing the problem of clericalism. Our guest, Thomas Groom, is one of those scholars. He's a professor of theology and religious education at Boston College. He is also a former priest and one of the lead authors of the document titled To Serve the People of God, Renewing the Conversation on Priesthood and Ministry. Would you put this call for recasting the priesthood in the context of the summit that's happening now in Rome?
Yes. Well, what Pope Francis frequently refers to the great problems in the church and places it at the feet of what he calls the curse of clericalism. Now, what does he mean by it? It's obviously, when you read him tightly, it's some kind of adulation, elevation of the priest above the people, not as a co-worker in the vineyard of the Lord, helping the whole community to live their faith, but rather as somebody over the people and lording it over the people. Now, he sees that as a deep problem. Now, it's fine to condemn clericalism, but clericalism arises from a certain kind of a theology, of an understanding, an exalted, exaggerated understanding of priesthood. Now, if I could quickly put it in a historical context, the Catechism of the Council of Trent, which was the primary document that implemented the documents of Trent, they refer to priests as gods. Now, it's a small g, but nonetheless, I mean, that's why Sister Bridget in second grade told me that if I was passing through the village and I met Father Murphy and I met my guardian angel, I should salute Father Murphy first.
Yes.
Because he indeed was closer to God even than the angels. So at least in Catholic culture, this exalted, exaggerated imaging of priests grew up. That has to be debunked.
So how does the document address first that clericalism, and how would it undo that in the priesthood?
Well, we begin by saying, let's rethink what priesthood is. So instead, our document doesn't really get into the controversy about, well, should women be ordained? Should married people be ordained? We simply say, before we get to there, and indeed we have to get to there, let's step back and ask the question, what does it mean to be ordained? And it is calling people then to collaborative ministry in the midst of the whole people of God, engaging the gifts of the whole community rather than lording it over them. One of the great emphases traditionally is that the priest has the power to preside at Eucharist.
Eucharist meaning communion.
But exactly. But it's also, the priests are also called to preach well and to break open the Word of God in ways that are relevant and engaging for people's lives, and to pastor well, which doesn't mean to lord it over. It means to engage the gifts of the community and put them all to work together.
So the document doesn't come out and support the ordaining of women as priests or allow priests to be married. Is that not, though, part of what you think would reform the priesthood for the better?
Well, that has to be the conversation has to be engaged. But I think the conversation around what is priesthood, what does it mean to be ordained, I think that's a prior conversation. That's what we tried to do in this document we created. Now, when we come to list the criteria for priesthood, in other words, what are the gifts, what are the charisms, that we would say, that one needs to be a good priest? You'll notice, and I'm sure other people will notice too, we don't mention maleness, and we don't mention celibacy as prerequisites. As Pope Francis, and we quote him at the end of our document, says, the future of priesthood will definitely not look the same as the present or the past.
But the Pope has also not said that he's entertaining the idea of women as being ordained priests.
Well, he's not, but some of his cardinals, Cardinal Schönborn, for example, of Austria, there are other people beginning to talk about it. And of course, if you ask that question, I would say of 90% of the Catholic theologians, at least of North America, they would see it as an open question rather than a closed question. The church proceeds as if it's a closed question, but there's very few Catholic theologians that would agree with that interpretation.
So by omission, you and others who wrote the document are saying that celibacy should not be a requirement. What do you think that celibacy in the priesthood has to do with sexual abuse?
I don't think there's a correlation between celibacy and sexual abuse. I mean, the evidence, the research doesn't indicate that. I mean, and then you can cite all the married men and some women who are indeed pedophiles and abusive of children and they're married. I mean, on the other hand, if there were women present in priests' lives, I mean, intimately present as spouses, as parents, as grandparents together, I think it would be a totally different culture, a totally different dynamic. I often said it years ago, if Cardinal Law, who presided over the Boston Archdiocese at the beginning of the great scandal here in Boston in 2002, had had a couple of grandmothers in his cabinet, he would have acted farce. He wouldn't have done what he did, moving abusive priests around, because those grannies would have objected. So that there's a real loss to the church in excluding women.
How would you make sure that people who are really called to the faith genuinely make it to the priesthood, and those who are there for the wrong reasons do not become priests?
I think we have to increase the intensity of the review of candidates. I think there has to be a whole review of the process. And I would be very much in favor of putting lay people on the admissions committees of our seminaries and theologates. Lay people who would discern rather quickly whether a young person, male or female, was going to make a good priest. Now, the tendency has been, and we know this, it's a common whisper, that the church has been taking into its seminaries people that 20, 30, 40 years ago never would have been admitted. But given the scarcity now, almost any warm body that shows up and can talk their way in there, that has to stop and cease.
That's so disillusioning. I mean, what's propagated that?
Well,
why has that been allowed to happen?
Well, I suppose it's the exigency of numbers, that they don't want to leave parishes, good, vibrant parishes closed for lack of a priest. So I suppose they will sometimes then overlook peculiarities, shall we say, and idiosyncrasies. And at least in some instances, there's evidence that the selectivity has been rather poor.
So how would the priesthood look different if it changed the way you're calling for it to change?
One of the things that our document calls for is a whole different approach to seminary formation. Not necessarily locking up all these young and middle-aged men together, taught by other men, all taught by priests, in little clerical enclaves. It's not the way to prepare people for priesthood.
Is that to avoid any kind of sexual contact, or is it more the issue of insularity?
I think it's insularity, and it gives them a rarefied sense of themselves, an exalted and exaggerated sense of themselves. They get preferential and deferential treatment from the very beginning. It's not healthy.
What kind of difference do you expect a paper that's been a long time in coming? I mean, you started this effort years ago, correct?
About 2 years ago, yeah. We spent 2 years studying.
I mean, you're very familiar with the insularity of the church, how the church protects itself, how things may be changing, but at this point, the church is not a rapidly changing institution. So how much hope do you have that an effort like this can make a difference?
Well, our hope is to create a new conversation around priesthood. In fact, a meeting we had in Rome, myself and a colleague, talking about the work of our seminar, we asked them, some of the leaders in the Congregation for the Clergy, which is the one that oversees priests, are you open to a new conversation around priesthood? Do we need a new conversation? And they agreed, heartily agreed, that yes, we need a new conversation. So I think there can be a backhanded blessing somehow, that God can sometimes draw good out of evil. God never causes the evil. But yet, when evil happens, God can sometimes draw good out of it. And I think this can be some of the good that might get drawn out of the dreadful evil and crimes that were committed, that we would stop and pause and rethink and reimagine priesthood in far more faithfulness to the tradition. I mentioned the Council of Trent earlier. That was the 16th century. If we go back into the early centuries, and this is what our research did, we went back into the history, the theology of ministry in the early church and early Christian communities, looking for the threads that could provide us with a contemporary theology of priesthood. We found them there. They are there. They're not the adulating kind of exalted pedestalizing that you find at the Council of Trent. It's much more a servant of the servants of the people.
The Pope has a copy of this, or at least I think his office does. You've seen to that.
The Pope Francis has received it. We know that. And
I know some of
his staff are reading it. Uh-huh. We've had some intimations of that. Whether he gets to read it or not, or has somebody read it for him, we're hoping, of course, that he may read it and that we'll all get the call to Rome to explain it or something. But anyway, but the main thing is that we start a new conversation.
The document is called To Serve the People of God, Renewing the Conversation on Priesthood and Ministry. It's from Boston College's Seminar on Priesthood Ministry for the Contemporary Church, which was started by our guest, Professor Thomas Groom. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.